This episode of New Politics was released on the 7th of May, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, week four of the election campaign and an interest rate rise, Scott Morrison rubbishes a home ownership scheme he once supported, and should there be a royal commission into the management of the pandemic? I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, satirist.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. The week commenced with the Labor launch on Sunday, and it was held in Perth for the first time in a very, very long time. There was a big deal about the location, and there were suggestions that the launch was held in Perth because Labor needs to win seats in Western Australia to secure an election victory. But it could also be a psychological signal to suggest Labor is confident in many other states around Australia and wants to shore up as many seats as possible. Now, it doesn't really matter too much where a party's election launch is held. It's only available to invited travelling media, party branch members and MPs, and it's mainly a televisual event. But it does signal that Labor wants to get away from that New South Wales-Victoria nexus, which has dominated federal politics for far too long. Now, you would also think that campaign launches would be held when the campaign actually commences, but for some time now, parties have been holding their campaign launches in the final week before the election. This time around, Labor has held their launch 3 weeks from election day. Is this a good idea or is it a mistake?
I think it's a very clever idea. I think that they're trying to catch on to the pre-polling. Now, last election, pre-polling was up a large number. New South Wales, for example, 30% of people pre-polled. Northern Territory, it was 42.9%. Victoria was 37.2%. So around a third of voters going to the pre-polls, which suggests a whole range of things. One, we're in a new society where Saturday has been traditionally a great day to vote. One of the advantages that we have over America and Britain is that more people can turn up to vote on a Saturday than they can on a Tuesday and a Thursday, which are the American and British models. In Australia, for a long time, not as many people worked on a Saturday as they did on the weekday. We've found now, and this is to the credit of the Australian Electoral Commission, there's people who can't vote on Saturdays, apart from the normal conscientious objectors, those who refuse to vote for religious reasons. You have people with differing work hours, you have people with differing lifestyles, which makes Saturday quite difficult to vote. So the pre-poll makes sense. And I think Labor is looking at trying to get to as many of those votes as they possibly can. Now, of course, the frustrating thing is that those votes don't get counted till the main ones have been cast on the Saturday get done. So if the election is close, it could be some time before we hear. I'm not sure that the election will be that close, to be quite honest. I'm starting to get a feeling that we will get a result on the Saturday night. But there'll be seats where they won't have a member for a couple of weeks. And maybe the rules get changed, that the pre-polls get counted along with the main votes on the night.
So political parties have held their launches quite late in recent election campaigns, probably the past 7 or 8 election campaigns, and quite often it's in the final week of the campaign. And the reason is that they continue to get public funding up until that time that they formally launch their campaign. So that's the main reason. But Anthony Albanese launching at the end of week 3 suggests that they're taking on a different approach. Pre-polling opens on May the 9th. So it suggests that they're basing their campaign on an election fortnight rather than election day on May the 21st. And in the 2019 federal election, Labor actually won the vote on election day. But in the preceding three-week pre-poll period, it lost it quite dramatically. As you mentioned before, in the 2019 federal election, almost a third of people voted before election day. And almost 54% of those people voted for the coalition in two-party preferred voting. And one of the recommendations from the Labor Party review of the 2019 election suggested that they focus too much on the actual election day instead of the entire pre-polling period. And in this election, because of coronavirus issues, it's likely that pre-polling as well as the postal vote will be much higher. So it's the party that focuses its attention not just on election day, but the entire fortnight beforehand, which includes the pre-polling period, is the one that will win out. And I suspect that that's why Labor held their launch early. They've considered that the election is being held between May the 9th to the 21st, and not just on May the 21st. So that's the strategy behind the early launch. But the launch itself was the fairly standard approach. The Labor campaign is a better future and is based around five key themes, and that's medicine, manufacturing, gender pay, equity issues, electric vehicles and housing. And these are the ideas Labor plans to run with over the next fortnight. Journalists have been complaining about a lack of policy, but they only ask for policy from Labor so that they can attack it and misrepresent it. So Labor has restricted its announcements on detailed policy. And why wouldn't they do that after being so severely misrepresented at the 2019 federal election? Scott Morrison's approach has been to absolutely rubbish every idea presented by Albanese, especially the shared government equity home ownership scheme, where he suggested that not only would households have banks at their kitchen tables, but also Anthony Albanese as well. Now, David, who would you rather have at the kitchen table? Anthony Albanese, where at least you'd get a good conversation about DJing, music, and be able to compare your Spotify lists, or Scott Morrison, who would probably talk about himself all night long and bring out the ukulele?
It's really a no-brainer, isn't it? I really think Scott Morrison does have an inflated opinion of how personally popular he is. He's going to highly, highly managed events where, of course, everybody there likes him, or at least pretends to like him. He's not really out in the community where most people are expressing their dislike for him. And a lot of those voting for him are voting for him not because they like him, but because they're worried about the alternative because of the propaganda going around, or whatever reason. So to bring that type of comparison up may well have been a massive tactical error by the Prime Minister, because the whole "we don't know who he is" thing failed. And now it's, oh, who would you rather have at dinner? Well, we've seen you at dinner in a couple of these prepared media things, and it didn't come across terribly well. Of all the last leaders, you could probably have a decent time at dinner with all of them. I don't think Scott Morrison is, and I'm sorry to say that, but it's true.
Oh, well, I guess it also depends on what's actually on the menu. But all of this stuff about Anthony Albanese is going to be at your kitchen table and those sort of ideas and that sort of rhetoric, well, that's just standard retail politics. And it just means that the actual policy announcement itself just wasn't looked at all. It was all about, is Anthony Albanese going to be at your kitchen table? So just looking at that home ownership plan launched by Labor, it's only a small, modest plan that will apply to 10,000 loans. The idea is that the government will support up to 40% equity in a home purchase for people with a taxable income under $90,000 for single people and $120,000 for couples. Now, there's many people you would think at those sort of rates would qualify for the scheme, but there's only 10,000 loans available. So it doesn't seem like it would cover enough people, but it's also small enough to not create wholesale changes to supply and push house prices up, which would sort of defeat the purpose of the policy anyway. But to me, it's only a small policy. It's a small and targeted policy, but it does seem like a sensible policy. And the Liberal Party also has a similar type of policy, but that didn't stop Scott Morrison from dismissing the plan, even though he said it was a fantastic idea back in 2010.
It's the biggest challenge facing those who have mortgages. You've got to keep your job, to keep your home. And yesterday we suggested that the government take out of that $8 billion they put aside for residential mortgage-backed securities, they take $500 million of that that is already out there and put that into shared equity mortgages. Because shared equity mortgages are a really good opportunity. If you do get into mortgage stress, you can reconsolidate your mortgage and you can go into a situation where you can have the bank take effectively a portion of equity in your property. And that way you can reduce your payments. And
I suspect that the incredibly high housing prices all across the capital cities in Australia is an intractable problem. And it's also the result of ridiculous government housing policies across state and federal governments over the past 30 years. And it's hard to know what the precise solution is at this stage. It's a complex problem that needs a wide range of complex solutions. But I guess the solutions do have to start somewhere.
If it was an easy problem to fix, they would have done it. The big elephant in the room, of course, is the massive tax advantages you get for owning more than one property. And if we could reform those so it was limited, so that you got those advantages on your first home after purchase, and then after that everything was treated as normal, that might be a way to solve it. I don't know that it's quite practical to just axe it altogether, but you could ease it out only because of the pressure then it would put on supply and demand and people in their one home losing all their equity because of other people who were able to offload their properties cheaper. There's a housing shortage crisis. A lot of houses are laying empty in Sydney and Melbourne, at least. It's, again, not an easy problem. You don't want to disadvantage those who are trying to get into the market. House prices are too high at the moment, so you want to encourage people in. And I think this type of policy might be the way, where the government does own 40% or 50% or whatever, but it's 40%. And then when you sell the house, you pay them back. And of course, a lot of this stuff will be far enough away that if it is problematic, a government of the time could work on solutions to that problem as well. So I think it's a good policy. I hope it's a policy that works. And I hope that both sides of politics get behind it and work towards it to be the best and most efficient it can be.
In another issue that does directly relate to housing, that interest rate rise that we predicted last week has come to fruition, and it's not good news for the federal government. And it fed straight into the cost of living issues that have been discussed for most of this election campaign. The cash rate has gone up from 0.1% to 0.35%, and true to form, a journalist asked Albanese what the cash rate was, and he got it right this time, 0.35%. Morrison's immediate response was to say that an interest rate rise hasn't got anything to do with him. Holders of mortgages have already factored in rate rises into their household budgets, and all of this is not political.
It's not about politics. What happens tomorrow deals with what people pay on their mortgages. That's what I'm concerned about. It's not about what it means for politics. I mean, sometimes you guys always see things through a totally political lens. I don't.
And here's what Anthony Albanese had to say about that.
For this guy to say that anything is not political, this is a guy who gets up in the morning and what he has for breakfast is political. This is a guy who, when he was in the lodge with quarantining, didn't take his economic policy advisor. He didn't take his national security advisor. He took his photographer. He took his photographer. Everything that this guy does is political. This guy, for everything, is an opportunity to play politics.
Interest rate increases and decreases will affect different people in different ways. If you haven't got a mortgage or if you're a renter, you've probably got nothing to worry about. And if you do have money in the bank collecting interest, well, it might end up being good news. And it also affects Scott Morrison in different ways as well. When interest rates go down, in fact, when any price comes down, he's quick to take ownership of that and let everyone know that it's absolutely due to his brilliance and his alone. But when interest rates go up, it's not his fault. He'll blame events happening overseas. He'll blame the war in Ukraine. He'll blame external pressures. He'll blame the coronavirus pandemic. Now, In my opinion, good political leaders should be able to take responsibility for all the good things that happen as well as the not so good things that happen, not pick and choose whatever favours their own political agenda at the time. They should be there for the good times and the bad.
It's the whole Westminster thing. The public service tends to do the work, tends to shape the policy into something workable, but shouldn't get any credit or any blame. It's the minister who takes full responsibility. So when things go well, as, let's be fair, they, until the last 10 years, often do, the minister can help bolster his or her career by saying, look what we did. However, if things go wrong, as they often have over the last 10 years, the minister has to take full responsibility, even if it wasn't his or her fault directly. And it's not terribly fair, but it is a swings and roundabouts thing. And it's not to deny the work that ministers have done in the past to shape policy and what have you, as well, and run departments. But that sense of these are the agreements. So when Scott Morrison takes credit for stuff, that's fine. When he, though, says that's not my fault, that's not fine, because even if it's not directly his fault as the Prime Minister, he's responsible for all of it. Now, with the interest rates, it's not his fault insofar as that he doesn't set interest rates. That is given to the Independent Reserve Bank of Australia. What Scott Morrison doesn't acknowledge is that it is government economic policy that also helps the Reserve Bank set prices. So how much is the government borrowing? What are they borrowing it for? How is the money being spent? What's the public service doing? What are the contractors doing? What is the exchange rate for the Australian dollar? All of that is part of it. And a lot of that is Scott Morrison's responsibility. Now, all he had to do was say, look, we're in a tough economic climate. We needed to slow things down. The best way to slow things down, because we've done everything else, was to raise interest rates a little bit. The Reserve Bank has done the right thing, and we will support those who are struggling with it in some kind of way, usually thoughts and prayers with him.
Oh, well, that message is just a little bit too complicated. It's easier just to blame everyone else and not take any responsibility at all. So that's who Scott Morrison is. He'll take the credit for all the good things and take no responsibility at all for the bad things. Now, he also doubled down on his attacks on a federal anti-corruption commission during the week, again calling it a kangaroo court and claiming that it would become a powerful autocracy that would curtail the activities of government. That's the whole idea of a federal ICAC, and that's why many people in the electorate want to see the introduction of a federal ICAC. Now, a few people have suggested to us, well, why doesn't he just bring in this federal anti-corruption commission, a strong one that's got teeth, and just get it over and done with? That's what the public wants. That's what he announced 3.5 years ago. So just go ahead and do it. Well, the problem is that it's not as easy as that, and you'd have to question the motivation for why a Prime Minister doesn't want to introduce a federal ICAC. And we've identified quite a few Liberal Party MPs that probably would have to face an ICAC if it was ever established according to the structures of the New South Wales Anti-Corruption Commission, and that's Barnaby Joyce, Peter Dutton, Christian Porter, Angus Taylor, Bridget McKenzie, Scott Morrison himself, Stuart Robert, Alex Hawke, Mitch Fifield, Malcolm Turnbull, Josh Frydenberg, George Christensen, Matthias Cormann, Gladys Liu, Michael McCormack, and you know, I've only just started. There's actually quite a few others that will probably go there as well. Now, we're not suggesting that any of those people are corrupt, and the federal ICAC is not a court of law, or it wouldn't be a court of law anyway. We're just suggesting that based on the many things that we've seen over the past 9 years, there are many areas a new federal ICAC could investigate that keeps them occupied for the first decade of their existence. And generally, politicians of all persuasions are reluctant to introduce these types of bodies because a lot of political activity does sail very close to the wind, and sometimes it goes past that point. Albanese was a little bit lukewarm when he first became Labor leader in 2019, saying that he'd never actually seen any corruption in Canberra for all of the time that he'd been in politics. Bill Shorten said that he'd have a think about it in the lead up to the 2016 federal election, and I'm convinced that he would have won that election if he promised a comprehensive federal ICAC at that time. Anthony Albanese has been more strident in his support for a federal anti-corruption commission, promising one within 6 months if Labor is able to form government at this next election. Morrison is now not very supportive at all, and we can see why. He'd be one of the first people to appear at the ICAC, and it's got the potential to destroy the federal Liberal Party and keep it out of office for the next 10 to 20 years.
I think the Liberal Party, remember Nick Greiner in New South Wales, who set up ICAC here. It was set up by his Attorney General, John Dowd, who did an exceptional job setting up a commission with teeth, a commission with adequate powers, and a commission that was genuinely independent. They put in the very well-regarded solicitor, Ian Temby, QC, and the first high-profile case was Nick Greiner. He genuinely believed that he was innocent of corruption and ended up getting off on really a technicality, because what he'd done was appoint Terry Metherill to the head of the EPA. He'd been education minister, fell into some kind of political dispute, left the party, resigned the ministry. So Greiner solved the problem by forming the EPA, which they were doing anyway. That's the Environment Protection Agency, and giving Metherill the job. So it looked like corruption. And often it just has to look like corruption.
Oh, well, I guess it's also a little bit like an alcoholic claiming that they're not an alcoholic. Corrupt politicians rarely claim that they're corrupt.
For sure. But Greiner made some comment that if Menzies had done this, no one would have blinked an eye. Again, not really recognising the inherent corruption in the system with the old boys groups and the school ties, the business connections, which are excluding potentially other people who may have been just as great out of the job. And this is what they've never really understood. It's not about good people getting the job. It's how they get the job, that there has to be openness and transparency, and that they have to be seen to be the best person through a proper process. Now, of course, there's a whole can of worms with this government. We've got water issues. ICAC in New South Wales found that Darryl Maguire was selling visas for cash at a time when there was a certain Scott Morrison as immigration minister who would have possibly had some knowledge of this. This needs to be investigated if he did or he didn't. And if he didn't, why not? And if he did, why didn't he stop it? I'm not suggesting anything beyond that implication needs to be investigated. And if everyone's clear, that's great. You let it go. We have ministers flying to buy houses on government expense, finding excuses to do charity work so that they can claim travel allowance. And some of this is minor stuff. But if you don't step on the minor stuff, the major stuff becomes a lot more prominent and prevalent. So we do need a federal ICAC or IBAC or whatever you want to call it.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
We've come a long, long way together, through the hard times and the good. I have to celebrate you, baby. I have to praise you like I should. We've come a long, long way together, through the hard times and the good. I have to celebrate you, baby. I have to praise you like I should.
And it also has to be remembered that it's not just the leader that makes up a political party. There's a wide range of other MPs that take up the slack and perform different duties. And during the week, there was a debate between the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, and the one who wants to take his job as the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers. And that was held at the National Press Club. The big focus was on cost of living pressure. And that's something that can't readily be defined, which means that the electorate can fill in the gaps. Cost of living means different things to different people, so it's the perfect political campaigning message. And of course, there's other economic issues that come into play. There's interest rates, there's national debt, there's budget management, there's electricity prices. The economy is always the focus of any political campaign. Labor's key talking points are that there's $1 trillion of government national debt with nothing to show for it, and they want to spread the benefits of the economy more equitably. The Liberal Party's key talking points at the moment are that it's been tough over the past few years. It's not good change in government at this point of time because there's so much more work that needs to be done. And this is all part of that you don't change horses midstream that Abraham Lincoln mentioned in his campaign work in the 19th century. But what do you do if your horse is no good or you can't get to the other side of the river with that horse? Well, you get a new one to complete the job. Now, I don't know how you'd get that new horse to the midstream or what you do with the old one, but you just have to make the change. And so all of this stuff about not changing midstream is rubbish. And it's a little bit like the New South Wales Labor 2007 campaign slogan, more to do, but heading in the right direction, which is essentially saying, well, we haven't been so good over the past 4 years, but we think we might be doing something right. That sort of rhetoric did win elections for Abraham Lincoln in the United States and for the New South Wales Labor Party in 2007. But is it the right sort of argument for Josh Frydenberg to keep pushing out to the public?
Josh Frydenberg is in a lot of electoral trouble. It looks like he is going to lose the seat that Robert Menzies held, and he founded the Liberal Party. So it's a seat of special significance. Now, I've said this before. It has gone down to an independent once before in 1921, so about 100 years ago. So we're in extraordinary times. Frydenberg has made few right moves in his campaign, and he's made a whole lot of wrong moves. Clearly a man who's never had to campaign for a tight seat before, and it shows rather than being put into a safe seat where he can rely on his performance as a minister. He's actually got to show that he's a local, and he hasn't been outstanding in that, I think is fair to say.
Well, Kooyong was previously a very, very safe seat, and that's why I suspect he was given it in the first place. Now, we've actually got some inside information that suggests that there's a very, very, very strong possibility Frydenberg is going to lose his seat. And that's not just because of that published poll that showed that the independent candidate, Monique Ryan, was leading by 59 to 41%. Those seat-by-seat polls are very unreliable and they could mean anything at all. But it's based on what's happening on the ground. And there's a feeling within the electorate that the Morrison government is on the nose. They possibly won't be returned or probably won't be returned. So they may as well turf out Josh Frydenberg as part of the deal. He's not going to be part of government, so why should he be there anyway? And as you rightly mentioned before, safe seats tend to be neglected by their local members, and that's why they're usually occupied by MPs who are ambitious. They aim high to be a minister or prime minister so they can focus on their ambitions rather than the needs of the community. Every election in every seat is really, really hard work, but it's even harder to win a marginal seat. And Frydenberg just doesn't have that marginal seat campaign experience. And there are now too many signs of desperation in more ways than one. All over the place in Kew, in Hawthorne, Camberwell, pretty much all of Kooyong is plastered with Josh Frydenberg billboards. Very few of them include the Liberal Party logo. Some of them just have Frydenberg's face with Keep Josh in large lettering. So all he's doing at the moment is throwing money into advertising, as if that's all you have to do to win an election. But all of this is a big, big mistake. It's the performance during the entire 3 years of a parliamentary term, not just the final 3 weeks. And it's also a signal that the Liberal Party knows it's likely to lose the seat of Kooyong to Monique Ryan.
Yeah. My favourite image so far has been the poster of Josh Frydenberg and the message on the poster is a stronger economy, and it's on a closed bank, which probably says it all. I don't know who thought that was a good idea. And it's possible too, given the toxic nature of politics, that it's his own people who've had enough of him. I don't know that for sure, of course. But I even think that even if he does win the seat of Kooyong, it will scupper his leadership ambitions, because the leader, he's going to have to spend the next 3 years basically being a local member, turning up to all the openings of schools and supermarkets and turning up to community grievance meetings and to have any chance of retaining Kooyong back to a safe seat. Because even if he wins, I don't think he's going to get in on a safe margin. We saw in the seat of Gladys Berejiklian's old seat, the candidate they parachuted in took it from a 35% swing to a 6% swing. So technically it's still a safe seat, but if he was hoping for an easy 4 years in New South Wales, he's not going to get it. So Josh Frydenberg's leadership ambitions are gone because he won't have time to be party leader. He won't have time to be an effective leader of the opposition. It's probably the start of the next period of reform of the Liberal Party, where they get rid of the Thatcherite, Reaganite, Howard mob and bring in actually genuine moderates, not the moderates who are moderates till they have to vote.
There's also been more wrangling about the leaders' debates. There has already been one debate on Sky News, and there's another one on Seven West Media next week, but only being shown after Big Brother finishes screening at 9 p.m. So it looks like that might be the final debate, and Scott Morrison has already ruled out a debate on the ABC. David, you've mentioned before that you think that debates have become irrelevant, and perhaps they've never been that relevant as far as changing votes in the electorate are concerned, but I think that they are in the public interest, and they should be there for the people who have an interest in politics. And I think it would be better to have these leaders' debates than to not have them, irrespective of how many people watch these debates. But there probably should be some kind of formula used for each election or legislation to support it, similar to what they have in the United States. Possibly two national debates at a media neutral location at the National Press Club, one debate with one moderator, and then another debate with the panel asking the questions, and not comprising journalists, but experts from different fields asking the questions, and one of each of these debates in the final 2 weeks of the election campaign. That might be a better process than just having these debates about having a debate or not, a set formula every election campaign, and that would be the end of it.
They're always welcome to come onto the podcast here and do the debate. We'd be very happy to moderate it, and I'm sure our listeners would love to join in a live stream where they could ask both candidates questions. One of my frustrations with it is that I'm not opposed to the debate as such. It's just how it's presented, what happens in it, and what they want out of it. They've been after the gotcha moment since Kennedy versus Nixon in 1960. Even Mike Pence getting the fly stuck in his hair gel last American election campaign. And it's a very much a presidential personality thing. Prime ministers don't have to be good speakers as such. It helps if they are, and it's preferable if they are, but you can have a not terribly good public speaker who's very good at administration and policy and running the cabinet and all of the other things that the prime minister does. But I would prefer a debate that was not about the dramatic television moment, but was about what does this candidate offer to the polity and what does this candidate offer to the polity. And of course, say, you're really only talking to the 10 or 20% of swinging voters. I don't know that anybody would watch, any committed Liberal voter would watch their leader speak and say, actually, you know, after all these years, the other side is right. Although that has happened this electoral campaign. But it's not something that is common, and it's not something that you could expect from that type of debate. I wish they had a bit more substance, is really what I'm saying.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached. Head is matted black, got the bushes black to match. Riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch now. Nah, can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Riding on a tractor, lean all in my bladder. Cheated on my baby.
And a catch up on all the opinion polls. There were four released during the week, and it's becoming a little bit like a broken record. There's not much change. If anything, they've become even worse for the Liberal National Coalition. The Resolve poll was the first one released this week, and that showed a two-party preferred vote of 54% for Labor and 46% for the Coalition. No change at all in News poll. That's at 53 to 47%. The Morgan poll slipped again for the Coalition. It's currently 55.5% for Labor and 44.5% for the Coalition. And the Essential poll is 52.5% for Labor, 47.5% for the Coalition. And that's an extrapolation that excludes genuinely undecided voters. We could have just repeated what we said on last week's episode of New Politics and the one before that and the one before that and the one before that again. The opinion polls haven't really shifted at all since the campaign commenced. But we do have to remember that Labor won over 100 consecutive polls in the lead up to the 2019 election. They ended up losing that election. This time around, Labor hasn't been behind in any of the past 104 major opinion polls, going all the way back to January 2021. And I know that this is putting it simplistically, but even if the opinion polls are as wrong as they were at the 2019 federal election, Labor is still in a winning position. And we talked about this last week, David. Everything has to go right for Morrison, but nothing is really flowing in his favour. And he's still trying to do the same tactics he adopted in the 2019 campaign: cooking curry, shooting balls on the pool table, scaring the electorate. This time, he's also signposting that idea of vote for us, we are not Labor. And I've got to say, this is one of the weakest reasons to vote for somebody. Vote for us because we are not like those people over there. And now he's saying that you can't run the economy like Harry Potter, when that's exactly what they've been doing over the past 3 years. In 2019, Scott Morrison had everything falling in his favour, and his high watermark resulted in a one-seat majority. And of course, that's still a victory. But this time around, he has to improve his vote. He actually has to pick up seats to hold on to government. And it's really hard to see how this is going to change or how this is going to happen with only 2 weeks of the election campaign to go.
Well, Labor need to win 7 seats, I think. And I think it's a minimum of 7 seats. 7 of the safest Liberal seats are in prime danger of losing. So that suggests less safe seats are going to go through. So I don't know that any prime minister, even Howard in 2007, has been in this position where they've slid back so much. Even McMahon in 72 did better than what everybody was expecting. I guess maybe Morrison is setting this up so that everybody's expecting he'll lose in a landslide, and in fact it won't be a landslide. It'll be either hung parliament, which isn't a bad thing, or a slight majority to Labor, or a moderate majority to Labor. And he can say, yes, but we were expecting a landslide and that hasn't happened. I guess the miracle might happen again and he wins, but that would mean holding every single seat he has now and maybe gaining one or two. Not impossible, of course, because nothing in these types of things is impossible. But there's a level of likelihood that makes it not very plausible or even possible. Even a temper incident isn't going to help. If there was some kind of terrorist attack, which of course nobody wants, I don't think that's going to help at this point, because even if he decides to act, he doesn't know what to do. And even a natural disaster isn't going to help. We've had, what, floods, fires? What have we got left? Earthquake, a tsunami of some kind. He's lost a lot of trust. And getting that trust back in 2 weeks, he's not going to shift numbers towards him in any great number over the next couple of weeks, I don't think. Here it is. Here it is. Here it is. Here it is.
And we're continuing to answer questions from our audience about the election campaign. Patrick, who is one of our Patreon supporters, he asked our opinions of the new Liberals who are campaigning under the acronym of TNL. David, how do you think the new Liberals will go in this election?
When we interviewed Ryan Bruce, he was quite clear-eyed about the seats that they were likely to win. Was a very honest answer and a very impressive answer. I think the official policy from Victor Klein is that we will win every seat we will go in, and there will be no opposition because we'll have won everything type thing. And I get that too. You don't want to go in with the big splash that they made and say, oh, we hopefully win one. You know, Clive Palmer the same. There's sort of three that are in play. But if they have a good long-term strategy, they may be a player. Now, it seems minor parties have a shelf life of about 20 years. We had the Democratic Labor Party from 1954 to about 1976, I think. 75, they start to lose influence and they hang around and they pop back up. But in terms of their influence, they're finished by the end of the Whitlam government. You had the Australian Democrats start, what, in 78, 79 and are finished by about 2000. Although they're coming back, as we will see in later podcasts. The Greens have managed to remain fairly relevant, although haven't quite, I think, got the influence they were after yet. Whether they will fade away again or whether they're about to build up and become a major party over the next few elections remains to be seen. But they're hitting about their 20 years of influence, so we'll see if that pattern holds. And obviously, future performance has no relation to past performance. I'm not quite prepared to state that. And of course, the National Party, which has been propped up by the Liberal Party since 1920, is a different thing again. With the TNL, if they play their cards right, they do have a real chance, I think, of being one of those parties that can be part of the balance of power in the short to medium term.
Well, the New Liberals do seem to be a hybrid party of all of these different ideas and amalgamation of all of these different political thoughts and ideas. Someone suggested they're like the Labor Party without the unions and the Liberal Party without corruption and big business. So they've still got a little way to go there. Nominations have actually closed for this election. So if anyone out there was thinking of running, well, you've missed out. You'll have to wait until the 2025 election. But in the seat of North Sydney, and that's where the New Liberals have probably got their best chance of winning a seat, there are 10 candidates. So there's a few candidates who we haven't seen before. So it's just really hard to see exactly what will happen here. We have to say that Trent Zimmerman, he's a sitting Liberal Party MP. He'll have a challenge holding onto the seat, but who it actually goes to is difficult to say at this stage. But the New Liberals, they are a new party, and this election is more about setting themselves up and building a platform for future elections. And I don't think they've got a strong chance of winning seats in the lower house, but North Sydney probably represents their best chance.
North Sydney has Kylie Tink as well, who I think has a very good chance. And I suspect what might happen, and I hope it doesn't, is that the vote will be split and Zimmerman will get through on fifth or sixth preference. For both parties' sake, I kind of hope that doesn't happen. I hope that North Sydney does get a strong independent, but we can't know till Saturday night, the 21st of May.
And we also had Alison ask a question through Twitter. Will an incoming government call a royal commission into COVID, nothing out of bounds, so that we can prepare for the next unprecedented crisis? Now, this, of course, is a very good question, and the answer would depend on who forms government. But I wouldn't expect the coalition to hold a royal commission into their own actions unless there's a hung parliament and they're force or hold a royal commission against their own wishes. And since they formed government in 2013, the coalition has instigated royal commissions such as the one into trade unions and into the home insulation scheme. And these were ideologically driven political stitch-ups. And the royal commissions that they have been forced to hold, such as the banking one and the aged care sector, they haven't acted on very many of the recommendations from either of those royal commissions. Labor does tend to hold royal commissions that are in the public interest or genuine inquiries of government interest. And an example of that is the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse into Religious Institutions. And that was commissioned by Julia Gillard. And I do think that a royal commission into COVID management would be in the public interest. And I'd certainly like to see one. Labor did announce on Friday that if they win the election, they would assess all the different mechanisms available to them and probably would hold a royal commission if necessary. So it hasn't been ruled in or out at this stage, but I'd say that there will be a royal commission into COVID management if Labor wins the next election.
There's a point in which we can only speculate and based on little evidence. I will say too that with the Royal Commission into trade unions, it turned out that the companies that the trade unions were dealing with were far more corrupt and that the trade unions were pretty honest. Now, I know that hasn't always been the case. There's been a few corrupt trade unions, but the terms of reference, which were set up specifically to nail the trade unions, didn't do it, couldn't do it. And with the pink bats, they found that Peter Garrett was actually one of the very best ministers, and his administration was of the highest standards. So even when they set up these witch hunts, they don't do it properly. They go after the wrong target, and then it makes them look bad. Then the next thing that the press was pushing was, oh, we're having too many royal commissions and we're sick of them, which I suppose you would be if the ones that you've done haven't worked. I think Labor will be very cautious in what royal commissions they appoint, not because they want to get away with stuff, but because if you do too many of them, things can go horribly wrong, and frivolous ones, and a royal commission should not be frivolous, undermine the intent and integrity of the whole movement. So I think Labor will act a bit cautiously, but I'm also prepared to be knee-deep in worms when they open that can of them.
So there's just two more weeks to go in this election campaign. Postal votes have already been filled in and returned. Pre-polling commences next week. So real votes are now being cast in the 2022 federal election. We're not mucking around anymore. You can almost reach out and feel the election with your bare hands.
The claims are going to get wilder. The promises are going to get bigger. Barely concealed tempers are going to become even less concealed. It's going to be a lot of fun, unless you're a mainstream journalist who thinks it's going to be boring and why do we have to do this?
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.